The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Conley, Judge Smith. The Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals, or to Zoom, or to your living room and boardroom or office. I'll just state for the record what the parties are aware of, which is that we are not live at the Minnesota Judicial Center today, but because of the ongoing emergency rules, we are appearing electronically by a electronic online platform of Zoom. Counsel, I will just let you know that even though we can see each other now and I can see your names on the screen, we are making only an audio recording, as is our custom, not a video recording. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so that those listening to the audio recording can keep track of who's connected to which argument. And because this is a technological experience, we as you might expect, occasionally we do have some glitches, maybe some stalling of the audio or video. If that happens at any time, whether you're making the argument or you're observing your opponent's argument, if you can't see any of the judges or hear, please just bring it to our attention as soon as you can so we can pause the proceedings and let the technology catch up to us so that we're not missing any of the argument and nobody's in any disadvantage. And with that, we are ready to hear your argument. And counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may unmute and begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. Thank you for the introduction and thank you for your opportunity to be before you here today. So this case has a lot of moving parts, so I think I'm going to just take it from the top. On March 6, 2016, Ms. Ruiz and her daughter and family were present at the Como Zoo close to the gorilla forest in an area that has been somewhat disputed as whether it should be characterized as a sidewalk versus a plaza. And I think that the initial part of what we get into here is a definitional challenge or textual challenge as to whether the recreational immunity statute applies. And at the onset of this, I would just cite to the 46603 subdivision 6E, which I think on its face plainly identifies that the first offset of language identifies that it has to be, quote, intended or permitted to be used as a park. The Como Zoo is really not a park, I think, by any definition. If there is to be meaning in language, that it can't be classified as a park simply because the city of St. Paul said it is. We get into the problem with that position that Como Zoo is actually much more than just a zoo. It is actually a multi-use facility. I understand that the law is clear. There is no proprietary requirement anymore about the nature of the immunity, but it is worth noting that the Como Zoo is used for purposes of weddings. They have various social functions. They even have a pay-for educational events that occur there. And lastly, they now have Como, I think it's called Como Town, which is really just an amusement park.
Well, so are traditional parks. I mean, so are you suggesting that there's a wedding in a very traditional park? And some that because the park is available for use for other things in addition to a traditional park, that the immunity statute somehow doesn't apply?
No, I think that's a great point. I mean, you can use those things in other areas, right? You can have weddings all over in parks and whatnot. But I think the issue that we get into is truly what is Como Zoo? And I think Como Zoo, so if you take your example and we shift it a little bit and say, okay, so the city of St. Paul has a maintenance facility building, and do they hold weddings there? Does that then change the nature of it being a maintenance building, or is it a place in which weddings can occur? I think you can do anything just about anywhere these days if you get the right permission from the right people. My only point in identifying that is that we're dealing with a very specific statute in a set of language that says, hey, it's got to be called a park and it's got to be a park.
Well, it's pretty broad language. Any property owned or leased that is intended or permitted to be used as a park. And there's no suggestion that it's exclusively used as a park, at least in the language as I see it.
Well, and I would say Como Zoo never is a park, right? I mean, there's no recreating at Como Zoo. You don't get to go play frisbee. You don't get to go feed the pigeons. none of that stuff is permitted inside Como Zoo, right? And I think that's the issue we get into, is that the remainder of the statutes that we identify at 82A, sub 1, 2, and sub 3 are pretty identifiable about what the nature of a park is. And then let's be frank, right? A zoo is really more of a conservation issue. I mean, it's in some areas, it's very contested as to whether zoos should even be permitted, because we're talking about the forceful caging of animals, some of which have no purpose in Minnesota. I mean, we don't have zebras naturally occurring in Minnesota and so on. And so I think from our perspective, we're submitting to you that even though the recreational immunity statute has been declared constitutional on its face, and we're not making, I think there's a, let me just get this in real quick, a bit of a misunderstanding. We're not challenging that the recreational immunity statute is not constitutional, right? We're saying it's not constitutional as applied to the facts of this case. And I think there's a distinguishing characteristic there. We're actually arguing for a very narrow tailoring in this case, based on the unique facts of this case, that doesn't exist in any of the other cases that have been argued thus far, at least that I could see on the reading of any of those cases, whether it was Johnson, whether it was Areola, whether it was the Mudbot case, and so on. But getting back to the issue.
How would you describe what happens at a zoo if it's not recreation? What's the word you would describe or use to describe what people are doing if not recreating when they go visit the zoo?
If they're not recreating, what would it be? Well, that's interesting, because I think in some of the deposition testimony, I actually inquired about that, because we're trying to make a distinguishing characteristic between what people do in museums, what people do when they're out for a stroll on the sidewalk. And I think in some contexts, we're talking about how you define them, those things, right? If we're talking about a layman's non-legal defined, you know, statutorily definition, yeah, I think when people go to a zoo, to some extent, they are there for their enjoyment. I don't know how to put it any other way than that. But when I look at...
So it is a form of recreation.
Well, not as defined, not under the defined definitions that we have under the statute. I think that's where our issue is.
I mean, counsel, so in order to just frame this more, the chapter 46603 has a list used as a park, as an open area for recreational purposes, or for the provision of recreational services. So it distinguishes between park and recreation. And then you rely on Chapter 86A, which has to do with outdoor recreation. I'm trying to understand, do you think a park is only a park if recreation takes place, even though there's a disjunctive phrase in Chapter 466?
No, I don't see
park being addressed in Chapter 86A, even if 86A, which deals with outdoor recreation.
No, I agree.
Okay.
No, but I agree with you. And I think that is in the disjunctive and talking about outdoor services. And I don't think you have to recreate to make it a park. I think I agree with that. But I do think we get into the functional purpose in the other cases that says, hey, if it's a recreational area, look, it's intended to be done doing certain activities, right? And my issue is that if open area, and this is part of what we had briefed, if open area for recreational purposes is so broadly construed, then a city could arguably come along and say, okay, resident in the community, you were walking on the sidewalk and you were chewing bubble gum and enjoying the day, weren't you? The answer is absolutely, of course. Okay, well then you were recreating in an open area. And what's to say that there's any...
Okay, I understand that. What's to say though then that this isn't a park? Let's leave recreation aside and let's see whether it's intended or permitted to be used as a park, the Como Park Zoo.
Well, because by their own terms, it was intended to be used as a zoo, ergo not a park. I mean, this area is clearly defined, right? I mean, and this is their stuff. They put out these materials. Como Zoo is Como Zoo. They actually refer to it for a period of time as Como Zoo and Park. And so, I mean, I can't, and I asked these questions in the deposition. I couldn't go into the main area of the entranceway of the zoo, sit down a tee, and pull out a golf club and drive a golf ball, right? I mean, you cannot recreate in there. You can walk and you can look. But we're on recreation there.
I'm just trying to focus on park. And right, I hope you also don't pull out a golf club at most parks where kids are around playing, no. But leave that aside. Why don't you address what Respondent says makes it a park, which is, you know, sort of the historical documents.
Right. Well, and I think that's interesting. When you get back and you actually looked at the initial enactment and land grant, you know, the question is, well, here it says it was granted as a park. Well, that's fine, right? I think originally the grant and the paperwork they've identified shows that it was intended at one point to be a park, but then the city diverted its use to something else. It's not a park, it's a zoo. And to some extent, I feel like this is kind of like out of the Wizard of Oz a little bit, right? It's a horse of a different color when we're talking about that. And I truly believe that's kind of what we have going on here. And I understand that may be a distinction that isn't accepted by the court, and I appreciate that, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of legal authority out there in this point, but at some point, I think you just don't get to say whatever you want in terms of expanding the definition of a park to encapsulate everything that occurs on it. I mean, there's even a case talking about where the city of St. Paul tried to argue that the boulevard was encompassed in the park. Same park, right? Same Como Park. And the court said, no, a boulevard is a separate, different land grant, right? And they used it for different stuff. It was a boulevard. And so it had different requirements for complying with the curbs and those kinds of things. And I think that therein lies our issue with as it applied in the constitutional basis for why we believe as applied in this case, it's unconstitutional. I do disagree fundamentally with what the trial court said about this is not an access case and therefore the ADA and these other parts don't apply. I couldn't disagree more. The Minnesota Disability Council has expressly identified that building codes and accessibility codes are relevant and for purposes of providing safe transmission of people, right? That's why they exist. And they may also have a secondary or primary purpose of accessibility for people with disabilities. But the building codes, the ADA, the accessibility codes, which are all adopted by the city of St. Paul, and something they are agreed to have been bound by, are for the safety of the people who enter the zoo, period. The question is, what do they require? It's a matter of timing, right? Building codes are when you build something, that's when it has to be built to code, right? But then after that, if such issues such as maintenance and care don't get performed, then you have other violations that occur relative to taking care of those things. And I think that's where we're getting into this, you know, when the trial court said, well, this is an accessibility case, these things don't apply. Well, the American with Disability Act and the various regulations that have been adopted don't limit them to people with disabilities. In this particular instance, at the date we had this, we had Edith Rudy's, a 78-year-old visitor, who was not particularly firm on her feet, who tripped over an item, which the zoo maintenance folks that we all deposed and identified, Mr. Orleanis and Mr. Hagel, all identified they voluntarily undertook the obligation to comply with that code and those accessibility regulations. And I think
so. How does the building code relate to recreational use immunity? It trumps it, or it's another exception to it, similar to the trespasser exception, or what?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. Because otherwise, if you're saying that they don't have any obligation to maintain the property consistent with those building codes that they've adopted and accepted that they're bound by, I mean, they testified they have no discretion to ignore those things. And yet here they are saying, but we're immune from them if we don't follow them. Well, that has a chilling effect on the regulation if they don't have to abide by them. I mean, in Como Zoo has several prior incidents, which we identified one of them in our materials, but they have a series of incidents that have occurred there over maintenance issues. No one's really contested that they're building code violations, but we hired a professional engineer who actually reviewed this and identified the specific violation. And they have a plan in order to address these things. They have an annual walkthrough. They're supposed to be doing these things to repair them. They say, if there's a problem, we have no discretion to ignore them, except when it causes injury, then we're not responsible for failing to abide by the building code that we're supposed to follow. I mean, it's very convoluted, I think.
And if I can just turn back for a second to your constitutional argument. Your constitutional argument, I understand, is an equal protection argument.
Yes.
The classification, and I think you brief it as being an as-applied argument. But the argument you seem to be making is that the classification that you find to be not satisfy the rational basis test is a classification between park-going people and non-park-going people.
Correct.
Is that not a facial challenge to the statute? I'm trying to figure out what that is, why this is as applied.
Right. Well, because I think facially, if you read the statute on its face, it passes all of those grounds, right? I think the other previous decisions are pretty explicit. You know, it's for the purpose, it's rationally oriented for providing for the continued use and maintenance of these park facilities and recreational facilities. I think that's fairly clear. But when you get into the aspect, when you throw in the, hey, there's a violation of a building code now, then we have a problem, because you can't have it both ways. You can't both have immunity, and say that you don't have to comply with the building code.
So the equal protection claim that you're asserting is not based on the difference between park-going people and non-park-going people. It's based on a building code argument?
Well, no, I think it's park and non-park-going people, right? So if, for example, the maintenance building, if we agree that it's not subsumed in the definitional stuff we were talking about, then you get into that problem, right? Because the maintenance facility, if this happened at a maintenance facility, we would never be dealing with recreational immunity at all.
So why is park going versus non-park going not a facial challenge to the statute that gives immunity for park going people?
Because I don't think the statute reads that way from my reading of it. That's the simplest way I can describe it. I do want to point out one thing though, because I'm running out of time and it seems to be a constant problem in my life. The case of Areola v. Stillwater, talking about actual knowledge, we identified the willful blindness portion, and I want to point out that circumstantial evidence can, by itself, can demonstrate that actual knowledge is possessed by the city of St. Paul. In this case, we talked about, they admitted they did all these regular reviews, walked through the facilities, and looked at everything on a daily basis for safety. And by those circumstances and the prior injuries that they had, we asked that you could find actual knowledge existed. I think I ran out of time. Thank you, though.
Very good. You will have 5 minutes of additional time for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
I don't get 10. Can I ask for 10?
You can ask for it, but you won't get it.
I'm not going to get it. All right.
You can spend your extra 5 minutes and go to the zoo and visit some animals. Council for Respondent.
Well, how about the museum?
There you go. Council for Respondent, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Mr. Ferguson. As a preliminary matter, the Como Park Zoo and Conservatory is just that. It is a park, and it also offers recreational services. And as a result, the recreational use immunity statute does indeed apply. It's operated as a park for over 100 years. There's no prior case law indicating that it isn't a park, and indeed recreational use immunity applies. Second,
What makes a park?
Sure. Merriam-Webster defines park as a piece of property or land that is used for ornament or recreation or a specific type of use. If we look to what is the definition then of recreation, that is refreshment or diversion. And visitors recreate at the Como Park Zoo and Conservatory. They can stroll the grounds, they can observe animals, they can relax on benches, they can people watch, they can have lunch. It's a great facility serving over millions of individuals a year free of charge.
Now, just so to be clear, everything you've just described could occur on a boulevard, on a city parking lot. All of those things can occur. So going to Mr. Ferguson's argument, virtually everything could be a park simply by this broad definition.
Sure. And you're right, Your Honor. It is a broad definition, but it also indicates the statute 466.03 indicates any claim based on the construction, operation, or maintenance of any property owned or leased by the city that is intended or permitted to be used. So we have to look at what is the intention or what is the permitted use. So that's where it's not quite as broad as what Mr. Ferguson is suggesting, but yet it does have a broad application for recreational purposes.
Well, I can understand your understanding of what a park is. Mm-hmm. Is there any distinction between a park and a zoo? Is a zoo always a park, is a subclass of park?
I would contend that it is, because I think what the issue here that plaintiff seems to continue to rely on is this kind of passive observer concept. And that is whether individuals can be, you know, kind of passively looking at things and observing things, and does the recreational use immunity still apply? And indeed it does, because if we look at things like the Habeck decision, although that was an individual on a hayride or being transported to the fairgrounds, it did apply it to the fairgrounds. So again, a type of facility or a type of land or property wherein it's more of a passive observer kind of concept. In addition, you have the mud bog races where individuals were observing the races. So I think that if we look to the intent of the city, the reason it was designed and constructed and maintained, all the historical documents we've provided, as well as the activities that occur there, it is indeed a park for recreational services.
Now, of course, we'll decide this based upon the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law. But if we look to the spirit of the law, isn't it intuitive that these sorts of statutes are based on some specific, the idea that there are certain activities that occur in these places that don't occur elsewhere, recreational activities, and unique to a park or recreational facility. And here you've got appellants are just walking along. There's no uniqueness to the unique recreational or park use activity. Should that concern us as we apply the statute?
No, Your Honor, it shouldn't concern you as apply the statute, because you actually have to look at what is the fundamental purpose of the property. And that's in fact what the court in the Unzin decision said, is we are going to look to what is the primary purpose of the property. And in this case, the primary purpose of the property is to provide a recreational service. And although it's a passive observer type service, that indeed is what it provides. So the recreational immunity statute applies both on the recreational piece, but as well as the park piece, because of the primary purpose and function of the property. It is to serve a recreational purpose.
Just so we're clear, by your observation element to your definition, a museum then would necessarily have to be a park as well.
Well, I think, again, we have to look to what is the primary purpose of the statute, and whether or not it indeed facilitates a recreational function. And that's what the court has said. So whether that court would deem, you know, a museum, we'd have to look at the specifics of that case.
So to understand, okay. So if you have a maintenance building at the zoo and it has hazardous substances in there, whatever, that end up hurting an employee or someone else who's, you know, or even just a guest, a visitor for some reason, and it's negligently stored, it's in the maintenance building, that because it's a building on a park property and all you're doing is, you know, walking past, there's immunity for the city for everything that occurs on that property.
Well, there isn't immunity for everything that occurs on the property because there is the trespasser exception. That right. is the only exception carved out for the recreational immunity statute. So whether or not...
So a hidden danger that someone didn't know, but, you know, like a hazardous substance or something like that, that injures someone in their maintenance building, trespasser doesn't apply, let's say.
Right.
Or it not hidden, it's open. Let's just assume it doesn't apply. It doesn't matter that that's not recreating. You're just
again,
walking.
We'd have to look at the primary purpose of the facility. And if it is to, like the golf course and the clubhouse, if the overall primary purpose of the facility or property is to facilitate a recreational function, then immunity does apply. That's the plain language, and that's the holding of historical courts dating back many years. And the only exception, the statute's been in place since 1963, and the only exception carved out is that for a trespasser.
I wanted to address the argument that you make on pages 4 and 5 of your brief. It seems as if you're suggesting that because of the historic designation as a park, then it necessarily is a park, regardless of what use the city and its residents make of it. So if I understand your argument correctly, if the city if someone dedicated land to the city and as for use as a park, and the city deviated from that use but didn't change the name, that it's still a park regardless of what happens because of its historic framing as a park.
The aspect of how a city is intended or permitted is within the plain language of the statute. So I believe, though, that to the extent that we are deviating, which we're not in this case, by the way, because the zoo is still recreational, and we still are a park and the zoo is still recreational. But to the extent that we were to change this to, something else, like we leased it out and then it became a gas station or something. We still have to look to, according to the case law, what is the primary function, the primary purpose, and does it facilitate some type of recreational purpose?
And not to, you know, I know this is like angels on the head of a pin a little bit, but the statute, chapter 466 talks about park and it distinguishes it from recreational services. The definition that you advance for park includes the word recreation in it, ornament or recreation. So it sounds to me like the city's argument is recreation is a necessary part of a park. It's just how you define recreation, even though it seems to be, you know, a disjunctive phrase or, you know, set of phrases in the statute.
Well, I mean, recreation is, but for ornament or recreation is defined under Merriam-Webster, right, for a park. So I feel like we're splitting hairs a little bit here, but yeah, I mean, that is subsumed within the definition of a park for that piece. So it's ornament or recreation. So we could argue easily as well that this is ornamental in that we have the passive observer concept as well. Individuals are able to observe these animals up close and walk around and enjoy the facilities.
And I haven't looked at other dictionary definitions of park, but why is it that that one is the one that guides us?
Well, I frankly just went to Merriam-Webster, and I believe also, I think in one of the footnotes, we've also cited a case, albeit I think it was an assessment case, that there's a definition of a park as well, and I'm looking for that. So in the case of Horn versus City of Minneapolis, park is primarily for recreation / refreshment of the strength and spirits. So there's another definition which we would argue similarly applies, as you have refreshment of spirits attending the Como Park Zoo and Conservatory.
On your definitional argument, the one that you build from the historic documents, it seems like you're relying upon the language of the statute that it that land that is owned or leased by the municipality that is intended or permitted to be used as a park. So if we read that literally, then a city would be allowed, for example, to to say that this land is permitted to be used as a park. It just so happens it's being used as a nuclear waste dump instead, but it's permitted to be used as a park. Your view, I guess, is that the language of the statute controls regardless of whether it's being used as a park or not, because it is permitted to be used as a park.
I think the permitted to be used as a park is a description for how the actual use at the time. I mean, we're looking again to the fundamental use the intended use at the time, and the city has designated as a park for its intended use.
I thought your argument was historic, that it was intended to be used as a park. So whatever is happening now doesn't matter, because originally it was intended to be used as a park.
It was intended to be used as a park, and it is continued to be used as a park, as a zoo. So we're not submitting that it's deviated in any way. It is indeed a park, but I do think you're right. At the time, if it were suddenly a nuclear waste site, as the city then changes its use, it's then not at the time being permitted to be used as a park. It's actually being permitted to be used as something else. So I think if you look at the mud bog case, for example, I believe that was like a sewer pond type area, and the city was allowing that area to be permitted to be used as a park or for recreational services at the time, indeed, the incident arose, immunity applies. So I hope I'm not speaking in circles here, but I think that's, or that is our argument. So Your Honors, given that I'm coming up close on time, the appellants have not established that the trespasser exception indeed applies. This is a park, it's also recreational services applied. The trespasser exception does not apply. It's incumbent upon appellant to establish all of the criteria for the trespasser exception, and they haven't. This is the Johnson case is precisely on point on this issue relative to the deviation in pavement, that it is not likely to cause serious bodily harm or death. There's no actual knowledge. The Aurora decision cited by the appellants specifically state that actual knowledge is required. The city had no actual knowledge of this condition. And in addition, it was not hidden or concealed. This is an open plaza area over which the appellants traversed, and there's no issue that there was any type of concealed nature was visible upon inspection. The photographs demonstrate that. Now, quickly, as it relates to the ADA and the Minnesota Accessibility Code, they don't apply. There is no exception to the for building code violations to the recreational immunity statute. And in fact, the recreational immunity statute subsumes any potential building code violation as cited by the appellant, as it states construction, maintenance, and operation. So from start to finish, the recreational immunity statute applies. In addition, they don't apply to the facts and circumstances of this case because neither plaintiff is the individual to which these statutes are directed. They are not disabled. And as a result, ADA and the MAC don't apply. Although prevention of personal injury may be a byproduct of the ADA or MAC, it is not the purpose. The purpose of the ADA and MAC is to prevent discrimination and there is and allow accessibility for individuals with disabilities. Neither plaintiff is disabled. This is not an accessibility case. This is not, there's no claim for negligence per se, and the ADA and the MAC do not apply. And finally, Your Honor, briefly, the Johnson case is precisely on point as it relates to the constitutionality of the statute and has repeatedly been upheld as constitutional. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. I do want to ask you one factual question. I wanted to save it until after you were finished so I wouldn't eat into your time because it's really not relevant, I don't think, to our analysis. I'm just curious, were these simultaneous falls? I didn't quite understand from the factual presentations I saw as to whether both of the plaintiffs fell at the same time or whether they were related and there at the zoo together. But trying to get a sense of, just for my own sake, do we know from the record, from the complaint, exactly what happened?
I understand that Ms. Ruiz fell and pulled down and went to kind of grab her daughter and was pulled down.
Got it. Okay. I was just curious, trying to picture in my mind what the movie would look like, but all right. Counsel for Appellant, you have the last word.
Very good. Thank you. Again, I want to appreciate everyone's good questions. So I want to kind of just work backwards, if we may. So first off, circumstantial evidence can be used to establish that they had actual knowledge. And so that's where I was going at previously. The case that we cited, the Areola v. City of Stillwater, says that actual knowledge is required, but it can be proven by circumstantial evidence and is used quite regularly in proving fraud claims in the criminal context for the actual knowledge component of that element. When we get to the issue about likely to cause serious bodily harm and injury in that aspect, the O'Brien case, was heard not long ago. And in there, they specifically talked about things don't have to be inherently dangerous, right? And I think that it goes without saying that given the amount of times the Court of Appeals has dealt with slip and fall, trip and fall cases, maybe not in the immunity context, but in just practical everyday experience in Minnesota, there are a lot of people who trip and fall and slip and fall and break ankles and break legs, or as the previous claimant with the city of St. Paul at the Como Zoo had slipped and tripped and fell on a 3-inch relief and fractured a hip. And when I get to that, the reason why that I think is relevant is that the factual record is pretty replete that when you're at the zoo, you're busy looking at things around you. You are not necessarily looking at your feet. And I think that is precisely why you see so many claims coming at the zoo, is that people are doing exactly what they're encouraged to do, and that is to look at animals and not pay attention to where they're walking, because they assume, right or wrong, they're assuming the city of St. Paul has done their due diligence in maintaining a safe walkway.
I'm trying to get a sense of why that doesn't cut against your argument, actually. The idea of recreational immunity is that people are doing things that make them a little less safe than they ordinarily would be. And you're saying that they're a little less safe because of the nature of the facility being one where you observe things around you. It's designed for you not to be paying attention to your feet. It seems to be this sort of accepting the risk premise to recreational immunity that would seem to fit the purpose of the statute.
Well, the difficulty I have is, and I love this conversation, because primary assumption of the risk is really a way of saying no duty. But if we're talking about secondary assumption of the risk, which is really contributory negligence, which is a jury question. And so I don't think it quite gets us there under this framework of the trespasser standard. I think those are all jury questions, not summary judgment standards, which is why we're here. I would also point out that the final part of the expert report, which I'm holding in my hand, actually talks about safe walking surfaces, which is something that the city has accepted. And it's actually a separate part of the building code. It's just not a straight American with Disability Act issue. And so I think that's important to point out, because I think that's getting lost a little bit, is that there's an obligation to continue to maintain and perform to have safe walkways.
Mr. Ferguson, counsel correspondent mentioned the Johnson case.
Yes.
Why isn't that case dispositive of all your claims?
Well, I think we get into the constitutional question that we identified. That case did not deal with.
Well, let's say, for speaking for myself only and not my treasured colleagues, I don't buy the constitutional argument. So again, why isn't the Johnson case dispositive?
Yes. So
it seems identical.
Well, from my standpoint, it isn't, because of the circumstances involving the. It's a side of the road, truck stop kind of watering area where you go, and it's a sidewalk in Johnson. And in this case, we have a situation where people are looking around, doing their stuff. And unlike Johnson, I think there's a significant issue here about paying attention to where you're going. And you have a huge concrete plaza with a very particular defect that exists in the middle. Johnson's a case where it's a straight sidewalk. And I think there is a difference in which those things are perceived by people who are walking there. So if the issue is the constitutionality argument, I think
Does this get back? Johnson's different because people are looking at the animals in the zoo?
Yes, and it's a giant concrete walkway. I think when you're talking about the perception of what you're visualizing, Johnson's a walkway that's 3 feet across. We're talking about an area that's a gigantic concrete thing with some areas that are level and no defect, and the spot where these folks fell, which was a particular defect, which was 1.5 inches, and it was raised. And I think that we get into that when you're walking along and not anticipating something, that's a problem. And that's the distinguishing fact I would make about it. And I think the photographs we provided, I appreciate,
I've never been to the Como Zoo, and now I'm absolutely terrified to go there. So,
if you look at the record,
I guess it's not just when the apes escape, it's just walking around looking at the apes when they don't escape.
Yes. I was hoping to address the maintenance building issue too, but my time is up. So thank you kindly for everyone's effort. I appreciate it. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you both for your efforts and the briefing and oral argument you've presented to us. It helps us certainly to get at the legal question, and which we will decide within the statutory period. The matter is under advisement, and this being our last case for oral argument, we are in recess. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good day. Be safe.